Do not try this stuff at home. Strategies like these resemble a high-stakes game of rock-paper-scissors at best, and the high transaction costs they entail will deprive you of any profit and eat into much of your principal. As Fama and his professor had discovered, stock market strategies that seem too good to be true usually are. Like the historical patterns on the frequency of earthquakes, stock market data seems to occupy a sort of purgatory wherein it is not quite random, but also not quite predictable. Here, however, matters are made worse because stock market data ultimately describes not some natural phenomenon, but the collective actions of human beings. If you do detect a pattern, particularly an obvious-seeming one, the odds are that other investors will have found it as well, and the signal will begin to cancel out or even reverse itself. Efficient markets meet irrational exuberance. A more significant challenge to the theory comes from a sustained increase in stock prices, such as occurred in technology stocks during the late 1990s and early 2000s. From late 1998 through early 2000, the NASDAQ Composite Index more than tripled in value before all those gains and then some were wiped out over the 2 years that followed. Some of the prices listed on the NASDAQ seem to be plainly irrational. At one point during the dot-com boom, the market value of technology companies accounted for about 35% of the value of all stocks in the United States, implying they would soon come to represent more than a third of private sector profits. What's interesting is that the technology itself has in some ways exceeded our expectations. Can you imagine what an investor in 2000 would have done if you had shown her an iPad and told her that within 10 years, she could use it to browse the internet on an airplane flying 35,000 feet over Missouri and make a Skype call to her family in Hong Kong? She would have bit Apple stock up to infinity. Nevertheless, 10 years later, in 2010, technology companies accounted for only about 7% of economic activity. For every Apple, there were dozens of companies like Pets.com that went broke. Investors were behaving as though every company would be a winner, that they wouldn't have to outcompete each other, leading to an utterly unrealistic assumption about the potential profits available to the industry as a whole. Still, some proponents of efficient market hypothesis continue to resist the notion of bubbles. Fama, in what was otherwise a very friendly conversation, recoiled when I so much as mentioned the B word. "That term has totally lost its meaning," he told me emphatically. "A bubble is something that has a predictable ending. If you can't tell you're in a bubble, it's not a bubble." In order for a bubble to violate efficient market hypothesis, it needs to be predictable in real time. Some investors need to identify it as it is happening and then exploit it for a profit. Identifying a bubble is, of course, much easier with the benefit of hindsight. But frankly, it does not seem all that challenging to do so in advance, as many economists did while the housing bubble was underway. Simply looking at periods when the stock market has increased at a rate much faster than its historical average can give you some inkling of a bubble. Of the 8 times in which the S&P 500 increased in value by twice its long-term average over a 5-year period, 5 cases were followed by a severe and notorious crash, such as the Great Depression, the dot-com bust, or the Black Monday crash of 1987. A more accurate and sophisticated bubble detection method is proposed by Yale economist Robert J. Shiller, whose prescient work on the housing bubble I discussed in Chapter 1. Shiller is best known for his book, Irrational Exuberance. Published right as the NASDAQ achieved its all-time high during the dot-com bubble, the book served as an antidote to others, such as Dow 36,000, Dow 40,000, and Dow 100,000, that promised prices would keep going up. Instead, warning investors that stocks were badly overpriced on the basis of the fundamentals. In theory, the value of a stock is a prediction of a company's future earnings and dividends. Although earnings may be hard to predict, you can look at what a company has made in the recent past — Shiller's formula uses the past 10 years of earnings — and compare it with the value of the stock. This calculation, known as the PE or price-to-earnings ratio, has gravitated toward a value of about 15 over the long run, meaning that the market price per share is generally about 15 times larger than a company's annual profits. There are exceptions in individual stocks, and sometimes they are justified. A company in an emerging industry, say Facebook, might reasonably expect to make more in future years than in past ones. It therefore deserves a higher P/E ratio than a company in a declining industry, say Blockbuster Video. Shiller, however, looked at the P/E ratio averaged across all companies in the S&P 500. In theory, over this broad average of businesses, the high P/E ratios for companies in emerging industries should be balanced out by those in declining ones, and the market P/E ratio should be fairly constant across time. But Shiller found that this had not been the case. At various times, the P/E ratio for all companies in the S&P 500 ranged everywhere from about 5 in 1921 to 44 when Shiller published his book in 2000. Shiller found that these anomalies had predictable-seeming consequences for investors. When the P/E ratio is 10, meaning that stocks are cheap compared with earnings, they have historically produced a real return of about 9% per year, meaning that a $10,000 investment would be worth $22,000 10 years later. When the P/E ratio is 25, on the other hand, a $10,000 investment in the stock market has historically been worth just $12,000 10 years later. And when they are very high, above about 30, as they were in 1929 or 2000, the expected return has been negative. However, these pricing patterns would not have been very easy to profit from unless you were very patient. They've become meaningful only in the long term, telling you almost nothing about what the market will be worth 1 month or 1 year later. Even looking several years in advance, they have only limited predictive power. Alan Greenspan first used the phrase irrational exuberance to describe technology stocks in December 1996, at which point the P/E ratio of the S&P 500 was 28, not far from the previous record of 33 in 1929 in advance of Black Tuesday and the Great Depression. The Nasdaq was more richly valued still. But the peak of the bubble was still more than 3 years away. An investor with perfect foresight, who had bought the Nasdaq on the day that Greenspan made his speech, could have nearly quadrupled his money if he sold out at exactly the right time. Instead, it's really only at time horizons 10 or 20 years out that these P/E ratios have allowed investors to make reliable predictions. There's very little that is truly certain about the stock market, and even this pattern could reflect some combination of signal and noise. Still, Shiller's findings are backed by strong theory as well as strong empirical evidence, since his focus on P/E ratios ties back to the fundamentals of stock market valuation, making it more likely that they have evinced something real. So how could stock prices be so predictable in the long run if they are so unpredictable in the short run? The answer lies in how traders behave in the competitive pressures that traders face, both from their rival firms and from their clients and their bosses. Much of the theoretical appeal of efficient market hypothesis is that errors in stock prices, like Bayesian beliefs, should correct themselves. Suppose you've observed that the stock price of MGM Resorts International, a large gambling company, increases by 10% every Friday, perhaps because traders are subconsciously looking forward to blowing their profits in Atlantic City over the weekend. On a particular Friday, MGM starts out priced at $100, so you expect it to rise to $110 by the end of the trading day. What should you do? You should buy the stock, of course, expecting to make a quick profit. But when you buy the stock, its price goes up. A large enough trade might send the price up to $102 from $100. There's still some profit there, so you buy the stock again and its price rises to $104. You keep doing this until the stock reaches its fair price of $110 and there are no more profits left. But look what happened. In the act of detecting this pricing anomaly, you have managed to eliminate it. In the real world, the patterns will be nowhere near this obvious. There are millions of traders out there, including hundreds of analysts, who concentrate on the gambling industry alone. How likely is it that you will have been the only one to have noticed that this stock always rises by 10% on Friday. Instead, you're usually left fighting over some scraps. A statistical pattern that might or might not be meaningful, that might or might not continue into the future, and that might or might not be profitable enough to cover your transaction costs, and that other investors are competing with you to exploit. Nevertheless, all that competition means that the market should quickly adjust to large pricing errors, and that the small ones may not be worth worrying about. At least, that's how the theory goes. But most traders, and especially the most active traders, are very short-term focused. They will arbitrage any profit opportunity that involves thinking a day, a month, or perhaps a year ahead, but they may not care very much about what happens beyond that. There may still be some predictability out there. It is just not within their job description to exploit it. The Stampeding Herd. Henry Blodgett first came to the nation's attention in 1998. After some meandering years split between freelance journalism and teaching English in Japan, he had settled in at a job analyzing internet stocks for the company CIBC Oppenheimer. As attention to internet stocks increased, attention to Blodgett's analysis did as well. And in December 1998, he issued a particularly bold call in which he predicted that the shares of Amazon.com, then valued at $243, would rise to $400 within a year. In fact, they broke the $400 barrier barely 2 weeks later. Such was the mania of the time that this may even have been a self-fulfilling prophecy. Amazon stock jumped nearly 25% within a few hours on the basis of Blodgett's recommendation. The call helped catapult Blodgett to fame, and he took a multi-million dollar job as an analyst for Merrill Lynch. Blodgett has a particular gift for distilling the zeitgeist of the market into coherent sentences. "What investors are buying," Blodgett said of internet stocks in 1998, "is a particular vision of the future." His way with words and reputation for success led to ubiquitous television and radio appearances. Blodgett's call on Amazon still looks pretty good today. The shares he recommended at a price of $243 in 1998 would have traded as high as $1,300 by 2011 if measured on the same scale. He urged investors to pay for value, concentrating on industry leaders like Amazon, Yahoo, and eBay, and noting that most of the smaller companies would merge, go bankrupt, or quietly fade away. In private correspondence, he trashed small companies with dubious business strategies, LifeMinders Inc., 24/7 Media, and InfoSpace, all of which turned out to be pretty much worthless and lost 95 to 100% of their value. The problem, the big problem, is that despite criticizing them privately, Blodgett had recommended stocks like LifeMinders publicly, maintaining buy ratings on them and defending them on TV. Moreover, the discrepancies seemed to favor companies with whom Merrill did banking business. Later charged with fraud by the Securities and Exchange Commission, Blodgett disputed some details of the case, but eventually settled for a $4 million fine and a lifetime ban from stock trading. Blodgett knows that whatever he says about Wall Street will be taken skeptically. The piece he once wrote for Slate magazine on the Martha Stewart trial had a 1,021-word disclosure statement attached to it. He has had time, however, to digest the work of economists like Fama and Shiller and compare it with his actual experience as a Wall Street insider. He has also embarked on a new career as a journalist. Blodgett is now the CEO of the highly successful blogging empire Business Insider. All this has given him a mature, if somewhat jaded, perspective on the lives of analysts and traders. "If you talk to a lot of investment managers," Blodgett told me, "the practical reality is they're thinking about the next week, possibly the next month or quarter. There isn't a time horizon. It's how you're doing now relative to your competitors. You really only have 90 days to be right. And if you're wrong within 90 days, your clients begin to fire you. You get shamed in the media, and your performance goes to hell. Fundamentals do not help you with that." Consider what would happen if a trader had read Shiller's book and accepted its basic premise that high P/E ratios signal an overvalued market. However, the trader cared only about the next 90 days. Historically, even when the P/E ratio in the market has been above 30, meaning that stock valuations are twice as high as they are ordinarily, the odds of a crash over the next 90 days have only been about 4%. If the trader had an unusually patient boss and got to look a whole year ahead, he'd find that the odds of a crash rose to about 19%. This is about the same as the odds of losing a game of Russian roulette. The trader knows that he cannot play this game too many times before he gets burned. But what, realistically, are his alternatives? This trader must make a call, buy or sell. Then the market will crash or it will not. So there are four basic scenarios to consider. First, there are the two cases in which he turns out to have made the right bet. The trader buys and the market rises. In this case, it's business as usual. Everyone is happy when the stock market makes money. The trader gets a six-figure bonus and uses it to buy a new Lexus. The trader sells and the market crashes. If the trader anticipates a crash and a crash occurs, he will look like a genius for betting on it when few others did. There's a chance that he'll get a significantly better job, as a partner at a hedge fund, for instance. Still, even geniuses aren't always in demand after the market crashes and capital is tight. More likely, this will translate into something along the lines of increased media exposure. A favorable write-up in the Wall Street Journal, a book deal, a couple of invitations to cool conferences, and so forth. Which of these outcomes you prefer will depend significantly on your personality. The first is great for someone who enjoys the Wall Street life and likes to fit in with the crowd. The second for someone who enjoys being an iconoclast. It may be no coincidence that many of the successful investors profiled in Michael Lewis's The Big Short, who made money betting against mortgage-backed securities and other bubbly investments of the late 2000s, were social misfits to one degree or another. But now consider what happens when the investor gets his bet wrong. This choice is much clearer. The trader buys, but the market crashes. This is no fun. He's lost his firm a lot of money, and there will be no big bonus and no new Lexus. But since he stayed with the herd, most of his colleagues will have made the same mistake. Following the last three big crashes on Wall Street, employment at securities firms decreased by about 20%. That means there is an 80% chance the trader keeps his job and comes out okay. The Lexus can wait until the next bull market. The trader sells, but the market rises. This scenario, however, is a disaster. Not only will the trader have significantly underperformed his peers, he'll have done so after having stuck his neck out and screaming that they were fools. It is extremely likely that he will be fired, and he will not be well-liked, so his prospects for future employment will be dim. His career earnings potential will have been dramatically reduced. If I'm this trader, a 20% chance of a crash would be nowhere near enough for me to take the sell side of the bet, nor would a 50% chance. I'd want a crash to be a near certainty before I'd be ready to take the plunge, and I'd want everyone else to be in the sinking ship with me. Indeed, the big brokerage firms tend to avoid standing out from the crowd, downgrading a stock only after its problems have become obvious. In October 2001, 15 of the 17 analysts following Enron still had a buy or strong buy recommendation on the stock, even though it had already lost 50% of its value in the midst of the company's accounting scandal. Even if these firms know that the party is coming to an end, it may nevertheless be in their best interest to prolong it for as long as they can. We thought it was the eighth inning, and it was the ninth, the hedge fund manager Stanley Druckenmiller told the New York Times in April 2000, after his Quantum fund had lost 22% of its value in just a few months. Druckenmiller knew that technology stocks were overvalued and were bound to decline. He just did not expect it to happen so soon. In today's stock market, most trades are made with someone else's money. In Druckenmiller's case, mostly George Soros's. The 1990s and 2000s are sometimes thought of as the age of the day trader. But holdings by institutional investors like mutual funds, hedge funds, and pensions have increased at a much faster rate. When Fama drafted his thesis in the 1960s, only about 15% of stocks were held by institutions rather than individuals. By 2007, the percentage had risen to 68%. These statistics represent a potential complication for efficient market hypothesis. When it's not your own money on the line, but someone else's, your incentives may change. Under some circumstances, in fact, it may be quite rational for traders to take positions that lose money for their firms and their investors if it allows them to stay with the herd and reduces their chance of getting fired. There is significant theoretical and empirical evidence for herding behavior among mutual funds and other institutional investors. The answer as to why bubbles form, Blodgett told me, is that it's in everybody's interest to keep markets going up. Everything I've described up to this point could result from perfectly rational behavior on the part of individual participants in the market. It is almost as though the investors are responding hyper-rationally to their career incentives, but not necessarily seeking to maximize their firm's trading profits. One conceit of economics is that markets as a whole can perform fairly rationally, even if many of the participants within them are irrational. But irrational behavior in the markets may result precisely because individuals are responding rationally according to their incentives. So long as most traders are judged on the basis of short-term performance, bubbles involving large deviations of stock prices from their long-term values are possible, and perhaps even inevitable. Why we herd. Herding can also result from deeper psychological reasons. Most of the time when we are making a major life decision, we're going to want some input from our family, neighbors, colleagues, and friends, and even from our competitors if they are willing to give it. If I have a forecast that says Rafael Nadal has a 30% chance of winning Wimbledon, and all the tennis fans I encounter say he has a 50% chance instead, I need to be very, very sure of myself to stick to my original position. Unless I had some unique information that they weren't privy to, or I were truly convinced that I had spent much more time analyzing the problem than they had, the odds are that my iconoclastic view is just going to lose money. The heuristic of follow the crowd, especially when you don't know any better, usually works pretty well. And yet, there are those times when we become too trusting of our neighbors. Like in the 1980s Just Say No commercials, we do something because everyone else is doing it too. Instead of our mistakes canceling one another out, which is the idea behind the wisdom of crowds, they instead begin to reinforce one another and spiral out of control. The blind lead the blind, and everyone falls off a cliff. This phenomenon occurs fairly rarely, but it can be quite disastrous when it does. Sometimes we may also infer that the most confident acting neighbor must be the best forecaster and follow his lead, whether he knows what he's doing. In 2008, for reasons that are still somewhat unclear, a rogue trader on Intrade started buying huge volumes of John McCain stock in the middle of the night when there was absolutely no news, while dumping huge volumes of Barack Obama stock. Eventually, the anomalies were corrected. But it took some time, often 4 to 6 hours, before prices fully rebounded to their previous values. Many traders were convinced that the rogue trader knew something they didn't. Perhaps he had inside information about some impending scandal. This is herding. And there's evidence that it's becoming more and more common in markets. The correlations in the price movements between different stocks and different types of assets are becoming sharper and sharper, suggesting that everybody is investing in a little bit of everything and trying to exploit many of the same strategies. This is another of those information age risks. We share so much information that our independence is reduced. Instead, we seek out others who think just like us and brag about how many friends and followers we have. In the market, prices may occasionally follow the lead of the worst investors. They are the ones making most of the trades. Overconfidence and the winner's curse. A common experiment in economics classrooms, usually employed when the professor needs some extra lunch money, is to hold an auction wherein students submit bids on the number of pennies in a jar. The student with the highest bid pays the professor and wins the pennies, or an equivalent amount in paper money if he doesn't like loose change. Almost invariably, the winning student will find that he has paid too much. Although some of the students' bids are too low, and some are about right, it's the student who most overestimates the value of the coins in the jar who is obligated to pay for them. The worst forecaster takes the prize. This is known as the winner's curse. The stock market has some of the same properties. Every now and then, the trader most willing to buy a stock will be one who really does have some unique or proprietary insight about a company. But most traders are about average, and they're using mostly the same models with most of the same data. If they decide a stock is substantially undervalued when their peers disagree, most of the time it will be because they've placed too much confidence in their forecasting abilities and mistaken the noise in their model for a signal. There's reason to suspect that of the various cognitive biases that investors suffer from, overconfidence is the most pernicious. Perhaps the central finding of behavioral economics is that most of us are overconfident when we make predictions. The stock market is no exception. A Duke University survey of corporate CFOs, whom you might expect to be fairly sophisticated investors, found that they radically overestimated their ability to forecast the price of the S&P 500. They were constantly surprised by large movements in stock prices, despite the stock market's long history of behaving erratically over short time periods. The economist Terence O'Dean of the University of California at Berkeley constructed a model in which traders had this flaw and this flaw only. They were overconfident in estimating the value of their information. Otherwise, they were perfectly rational. What O'Dean found was that overconfidence alone was enough to upset an otherwise rational market. Markets with overconfident traders will produce extremely high trading volumes, increased volatility, strange correlations in stock prices from day to day, and below-average returns for active traders. All the things that we observe in the real world. Why it's hard to bust bubbles. And yet, if the market is trending toward a bubble, efficient market hypothesis would imply that some trader should step in to stop it, expecting to make enormous profits by selling the stock short. Eventually, the theory will be right. All bubbles burst. However, they can take a long time to pop. The way to bet against an overvalued stock is to short it. You borrow shares at their current price with the promise of returning them at some point in the future based on their price at that time. If the stock goes down in value, you will make money on this trade. The problem comes if the stock goes up in value, in which case you will owe more money than you had borrowed originally. Say, for instance, that you had borrowed 500 shares of the company InfoSpace on March 2, 1999, when they cost $27, promising to return them 1 year later. Borrowing these shares would have cost you about $13,400. 1 year later, however, InfoSpace was trading at $482 per share, meaning that you would be obliged to return about $240,000, almost 20 times the initial value of your investment. Although this bet would have turned out to be brilliant in the end, InfoSpace later traded for as little as $1.40 per share, you would have taken a bath, and your ability to make future investments would be crippled. In fact, the losses from shorting a stock are theoretically unlimited. In practice, the investor loaning you the shares can demand them back anytime she wants, as she assuredly will if she thinks you are a credit risk. But this also means she can quit anytime she's ahead, an enormous problem since overvalued stocks often become even more overvalued before reverting back to fairer prices. Moreover, since the investor loaning you the stocks knows that you may have to dig into your savings to pay her back, she will charge you a steep interest rate for the privilege. Bubbles can take months or years to deflate. As John Maynard Keynes said, the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. the price isn't right. At other times, investors may not have the opportunity to short stocks at all. One somewhat infamous example, documented by the University of Chicago economists Richard Thaler and Owen Lamont, is when the company 3Com spun off shares of its mobile phone subsidiary, Palm, into a separate stock offering. 3Com kept most of Palm's shares for itself, however, so a trader could also invest in Palm simply by buying 3Com stock. In particular, 3Com stockholders were guaranteed to receive 3 shares in Palm for every 2 shares in 3Com that they held. This seemed to imply Palm shares could trade at an absolute maximum of 2/3 the value of 3Com shares. Palm, however, was a sexy stock at the time, whereas 3Com, although it had consistently earned a profit, had a stodgy reputation. Rather than being worth less than 3Com shares, Palm shares instead traded at a higher price for a period of several months. This should have allowed an investor, regardless of what he thought about Palm and 3Com, to make a guaranteed profit by buying 3Com shares and shorting Palm. On paper, it was a virtually no-risk arbitrage opportunity, the equivalent of exchanging $1,000 for 600 British pounds at Heathrow Airport in London, knowing you could exchange the 600 pounds for $1,500 when you got off the flight in New York. But shorting Palm proved to be very difficult. Few holders of Palm stock were willing to loan their shares out, and they had come to expect quite a premium for doing so. An interest rate of well over 100% per year. This pattern was common during the dot-com bubble. Shorting dot-com stocks was prohibitively expensive when it wasn't literally impossible. I met with Thaler after we both spoke at a conference in Las Vegas, where we ate an overpriced sushi dinner and observed the action on the strip. Thaler, although a friend and colleague of Fama's, has been at the forefront of a discipline called behavioral economics that has been a thorn in the side of efficient market hypothesis. Behavioral economics points out all the ways in which traders in the real world are not as well behaved as in the model. Efficient market hypothesis has 2 components, Thaler told me between bites of Toro. One I call the no free lunch component, which is that you can't beat the market. Eugene Fama and I mostly agree about this component. The part he doesn't like to talk about is the price is right component. There is reasonably strong evidence for what Thaler calls no free lunch. It is difficult, although not literally impossible, for any investor to beat the market over the long term. Theoretically appealing opportunities may be challenging to exploit in practice because of transaction costs, risks, and other constraints on trading. Statistical patterns that have been reliable in the past may prove to be ephemeral once investors discover them. The second claim of efficient market hypothesis, what Thaler refers to as the price is right component, is more dubious. Examples like the discrepancy in pricing between Palm and 3Com stock simply could not have arisen if the price were right. You had the same commodity, the value of an interest in Palm, trading at 2 different and wildly divergent prices. At least one of them must have been wrong. There are asymmetries in the market. Bubbles are easier to detect than to burst. What this means is that the ultimatum we face in Baseland, if you really think the market is going to crash, why aren't you willing to bet on it, does not necessarily hold in the real world, where there are constraints on trading and on capital. Noise in financial markets. There is a kind of symbiosis between the irrational traders and the skilled ones. Just as in a poker game, good players need some fish at the table to make the game profitable to play in. In the financial literature, these irrational traders are known as noise traders. As the economist Fisher Black wrote in a 1986 essay simply called Noise, "Noise makes trading in financial markets possible, and thus allows us to observe prices for financial assets. But noise also causes markets to be somewhat inefficient. Most generally, noise makes it very difficult to test either practical or academic theories about the way that financial or economic markets work. We are forced to act largely in the dark. Imagine there were no noise traders in the market. Everyone is betting on real information, signal. Prices are rational pretty much all the time, and the market is efficient. But if you think a market is efficient, efficient enough that you can't really beat it for a profit, then it would be irrational for you to place any trades. In fact, efficient market hypothesis is intrinsically somewhat self-defeating. If all investors believed the theory that they can't make any money from trading since the stock market is unbeatable, there would be no one left to make trades and therefore no market at all. The paradox reminds me of an old joke among economists. One economist sees a $100 bill sitting on the street and reaches to grab it. "Don't bother," the other economist says. "If it were a real $100 bill, someone would already have picked it up." If everyone thought this way, of course, nobody would bother to pick up $100 bills until a naive young lad who had never taken an economics course went about town scooping them up, then found out they were perfectly good and exchanged them for a new car. The most workable solution to the paradox, identified by the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz and his colleague Sanford Grossman many years ago, is to allow some investors to make just a little bit of profit, just enough to adequately compensate them for the effort they put in. This would not actually be all that difficult to accomplish in the real world, although it might seem objectionable to you that securities analysts on Wall Street are compensated at $75 billion per year. This pales in comparison to the roughly $17 trillion in trades that are made at the New York Stock Exchange alone. So long as they beat the market by 0.5% on their trades, they would be revenue positive for their firms. The equilibrium proposed by Stiglitz is one in which some minimal profits are available to some investors. Efficient market hypothesis can't literally be true. Although some studies, like mine of mutual funds on E-Trade, seem to provide evidence for Fama's view that no investor can beat the market at all, others are more equivocal, and a few identify fairly tangible evidence of trading skill and excess profits. It probably isn't the mutual funds that are beating Wall Street. They follow too conventional a strategy and sink or swim together. But some hedge funds, not most, very probably beat the market. And some proprietary trading desks at elite firms like Goldman Sachs almost certainly do. There also seems to be rather clear evidence of trading skill among options traders, people who make bets on probabilistic assessments of how much a share price might move. And while most individual, retail-level investors make common mistakes, like trading too often, and do worse than the market average, a select handful probably do beat the street. Buy high, sell low. You should not rush out and become an options trader. As the legendary investor Benjamin Graham advises, a little bit of knowledge can be a dangerous thing in the stock market. After all, any investor can do as well as the average investor with almost no effort. All he needs to do is buy an index fund that tracks the average of the S&P 500. In doing so, he will come extremely close to replicating the average portfolio of every other trader, from Harvard MBAs to noise traders to George Soros's hedge fund managers. You have to be really good, or foolhardy, to turn that proposition down. In the stock market, the competition is fierce. The average trader, particularly in today's market, in which trading is dominated by institutional investors, is someone who will have ample credentials, a high IQ, and a fair amount of experience. "Everybody thinks they have this super smart mutual fund manager," Henry Blodgett told me. "He went to Harvard and has been doing it for 25 years. How can he not be smart enough to beat the market?" The answer is, because there are 9 million of him, and they all have a $50 million budget and computers that are co-located in the New York Stock Exchange. How could you possibly beat that? In practice, most everyday investors do not do even that well. Gallup and other polling organizations periodically survey Americans on whether they think it is a good time to buy stocks. Historically, there has been a strong relationship between these numbers and stock market performance, but the relationship runs in the exact opposite direction of what sound investment strategy would dictate. Americans tend to think it's a good time to buy when P/E ratios are inflated and stocks are overpriced. The highest figure that Gallup ever recorded in their survey was in January 2000, when a record high of 67% of Americans thought it was a good time to invest. Just 2 months later, the NASDAQ and other stock indices began to crash. Conversely, only 26% of Americans thought it was a good time to buy stocks in February 1990. But the S&P 500 almost quadrupled in value over the next 10 years. Most of us will have to fight these instincts. Investors need to learn how to do exactly the reverse of what their fight-or-flight mechanism is telling them to do, Blodgett told me. When the market crashes, that is the time to get excited and put your money into it. It's not the time to get scared and pull money out. What you see instead is the more the market drops, the more money comes out of it. Normal investors are obliterated because they continuously do exactly the wrong thing. As Blodgett says, these mistakes can be exceptionally costly for investors. Suppose that you had invested $10,000 in the S&P 500 in 1970, planning to cash it out 40 years later upon your retirement in 2009. There were plenty of ups and downs during this period. But if you stuck with your investment through thick and thin, you would have made a profit of $63,000 when you retired, adjusted for inflation and not counting the original principal. If instead you had played it safe by pulling your money out of the market every time that it had fallen more than 25% from its previous peak, waiting until the market rebounded to 90% of its previous high before reinvesting, you would have just $18,000 in profit, a meager return of 2.6% per year. Many investors, unfortunately, behave in exactly this fashion. Worse yet, they tend to make their initial investments at times when the market is overvalued, in which case they may struggle to make a positive return of any kind over the long term. The next time the market is in a bubble, you will see signals like the flashing lights in a casino drawing you ever closer. The CNBC ticker full of green arrows, Wall Street Journal headlines about record returns, commercials for online brokerages that make a fortune seem only a mouse click away. Avoiding buying during a bubble or selling during a panic requires deliberate and conscious effort. You need to have the presence of mind to ignore it. Otherwise, you will make the same mistakes that everyone else is making. Daniel Kahneman likens the problem to the Mueller-Lyer illusion, a famous optical illusion involving two sets of arrows. The arrows are exactly the same length. But in one case, the ends of the arrows outward seem to signify expansion and boundless potential. In the other case, they point inward, making them seem self-contained and limited. The first case is analogous to how investors see the stock market when returns have been increasing. The second case is how they see it after a crash. There's no way that you can control yourself not to have that illusion, Kahneman told me. You look at them, and one of the arrows is going to look longer than the other. But you can train yourself to recognize that this is a pattern that causes an illusion. And in that situation, I can't trust my impressions. I've got to use a ruler. The other 10%. The cognitive shortcuts that our mind takes, our heuristics, are what get investors into trouble. The idea that something going up will continue to go up couldn't be any more instinctive. It just happens to be completely wrong when it comes to the stock market. Our instincts related to herding may be an even more fundamental problem. Oftentimes, it will absolutely be right to do what everyone else is doing, or at least to pay some attention to it. If you travel to a strange city and need to pick a restaurant for dinner, you probably want to select the one that has more customers, other things being equal. But occasionally it will backfire. You wind up at the tourist trap. Likewise, when we were making forecasts in Baysland, it usually behooved us to pay some attention to what our neighbors were doing and adjust our beliefs accordingly, rather than adopt the stubborn and often implausible notion that we knew better than everyone else. I pay quite a bit of attention to what the consensus view is, what a market like Intrade is saying when I make a forecast. It is never an absolute constraint, but the further I move away from that consensus, the stronger my evidence has to be before I come to the view that I have things right and everyone else has it wrong. This attitude, I think, will serve you very well most of the time. It implies that although you might occasionally be able to beat markets, it is not something you should count on doing every day. That is a sure sign of overconfidence. But there are the exceptional cases. Fisher Black estimates that markets are basically rational 90% of the time. The other 10% of the time, the noise traders dominate, and they can go a little haywire. One way to look at this is that markets are usually very right, but occasionally very wrong. This, incidentally, is another reason why bubbles are hard to pop in the real world. There might be a terrific opportunity to short a bubble or long a panic once every 15 or 20 years when one comes along in your asset class. But it's very hard to make a steady career out of that, doing nothing for years at a time. The two-track market. Some theorists have proposed that we should think of the stock market as constituting two processes in one. There is the signal track, the stock market of the 1950s that we read about in textbooks. This is the market that prevails in the long run, with investors making relatively few trades and prices well tied down to fundamentals. It helps investors to plan for their retirement and helps companies capitalize themselves. Then there is the fast track, the noise track, which is full of momentum trading, positive feedbacks, skewed incentives, and herding behavior. Usually it is just a rock-paper-scissors game that does no real good to the broader economy, but also, perhaps, no real harm. It's just a bunch of sweaty traders passing money around. However, these tracks happen to run along the same road, as though some city decided to hold a Formula One race, but by some bureaucratic oversight, forgot to close one lane to commuter traffic. Sometimes, like during the financial crisis, there is a big accident, and regular investors get run over. This sort of duality, what the physicist Didier Sornet calls the fight between order and disorder, is common in complex systems, which are those governed by the interaction of many separate individual parts. Complex systems like these can at once seem very predictable and very unpredictable. Earthquakes are very well described by a few simple laws. We have a very good idea of the long-run frequency of a magnitude 6.5 earthquake in Los Angeles. And yet, they are essentially unpredictable from day to day. Another characteristic of these systems is that they periodically undergo violent and highly non-linear phase changes from orderly to chaotic and back again. For Sornet and others who take highly mathematical views of the market, the presence of periodic bubbles seems more or less inevitable, an intrinsic property of the system. I am partial toward this perspective. My view on trading markets and toward free market capitalism more generally is the same as Winston Churchill's attitude toward democracy. I think it's the worst economic system ever invented, except for all the other ones. Markets do a good job most of the time, but I don't think we'll ever be rid of bubbles. But if we can't fully prevent the herd behavior that causes bubbles, can we at least hope to detect them while they are occurring? Say you accept Black's premise that the market is behaving irrationally 10% of the time. Can we know when we're in that 10% phase? Then we might hope to profit from bubbles. Or, less selfishly, we could create softer landings that lessen the need for abhorrent taxpayer bailouts. Bubble detection does not seem so hopeless. I don't think we're ever going to bat 100% or even 50%, but I think we can get somewhere. Some of the bubbles of recent years, particularly the housing bubble, were detected by enormous numbers of people well in advance. And tests like Shiller's P/E ratio have been quite reliable indicators of bubbles in the past. We could try to legislate our way out of the problem, but that can get tricky. If greater regulation might be called for in some cases, constraints on short selling, which make it harder to pop bubbles, are almost certainly counterproductive. What's clear, however, is that we'll never detect a bubble if we start from the presumption that markets are infallible and the price is always right. Markets cover up some of our warts, and balance out some of our flaws. And they certainly aren't easy to outpredict. But sometimes, the price is wrong. Chapter 12. A Climate of Healthy Skepticism. June 23, 1988, was an unusually hot day on Capitol Hill. The previous afternoon, temperatures hit 100 degrees at Washington's National Airport, the first time in decades they reached triple digits so early in the summer. The NASA climatologist James Hansen wiped his brow. The air conditioning had inconveniently ceased to function in the Senate Energy Committee's hearing room, and told the American people they should prepare for more of the same. The greenhouse effect had long been accepted theory, predicted by scientists to warm the planet. But for the first time, Hansen said, it had begun to produce an unmistakable signal in the temperature record. Global temperatures had increased by about 0.4 degrees Celsius since the 1950s, and this couldn't be accounted for by natural variations. The probability of a chance warming of that magnitude is about 1%, Hansen told Congress. So with 99% confidence, we can state that the warming trend during this time period is a real warming trend. Hansen predicted more frequent heat waves in Washington and in other cities like Omaha. Already the change was large enough to be noticeable to the average person. The models needed to be refined, he advised, but both the temperature trend and the reasons for it were clear. It is time to stop waffling so much, Hansen said. The evidence is pretty strong that the greenhouse effect is here. With nearly a quarter century having passed since Hansen's hearing, it is time to ask some of the same questions about global warming that we have of other fields in this book. How right or how wrong have the predictions about it been so far? What are scientists really agreed upon, and where is there more debate? How much uncertainty is there in the forecasts, and how should we respond to it? Can something as complex as the climate system really be modeled well at all? Are climate scientists prone to the same problems, like overconfidence, that befall forecasters in other fields? How much have politics and other perverse incentives undermined the search for scientific truth? And can Bayesian reasoning be of any help in adjudicating the debate? We should examine the evidence and articulate what might be thought of as healthy skepticism toward climate predictions. As you will see, this kind of skepticism does not resemble the type that is common in blogs or in political arguments over global warming. The noise and the signal. Many of the examples in this book concern cases where forecasters mistake correlation for causation and noise for a signal. Up until about 1997, the conference of the winning Super Bowl team had been very strongly correlated with the direction of the stock market over the course of the next year. However, there was no credible causal mechanism behind the relationship. And if you had made investments on that basis, you would have lost your shirt. The Super Bowl indicator was a false positive. The reverse can sometimes also be true. Noisy data can obscure the signal, even when there is essentially no doubt that the signal exists. Take a relationship that few of us would dispute. If you consume more calories, you are more likely to become fat. Surely such a basic relationship would show up clearly in the statistical record. I downloaded data from 84 countries for which estimates of both obesity rates and daily caloric consumption are publicly available. Looked at in this way, the relationship seems surprisingly tenuous. The daily consumption in South Korea, which has a fairly meat-heavy diet, is about 3,070 calories per person per day, slightly above the world average. However, the obesity rate there is only about 3%. The Pacific Island nation of Nauru, by contrast, consumes about as many calories as South Korea per day, but the obesity rate there is 79%. If you plot the 84 countries on a graph, there seems to be only limited evidence of a connection between obesity and calorie consumption. It would not qualify as statistically significant by standard tests. There are, of course, many conflating factors that obscure the relationship. Certain countries have better genetics or better exercise habits, and the data is rough. Estimating how many calories an adult consumes in a day is challenging. A researcher who took this statistical evidence too literally might incorrectly reject the connection between calorie consumption and obesity, a false negative. It would be nice if we could just plug data into a statistical model, crunch the numbers, and take for granted that it was a good representation of the real world. Under some circumstances, especially in data-rich fields like baseball, that assumption is fairly close to being correct. In many other cases, a failure to think carefully about causality will lead us up blind alleys. There would be much reason to doubt claims about global warming were it not for their grounding in causality. The Earth's climate goes through various warm and cold phases that play out over periods of years or decades or centuries. These cycles long predate the dawn of industrial civilization. However, predictions are potentially much stronger when backed up by a sound understanding of the root causes behind a phenomenon. We do have a good understanding of the cause of global warming. It is the greenhouse effect. The greenhouse effect is here. In 1990, 2 years after Hansen's hearing, the United Nations International Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, released more than 1,000 pages of findings about the science of climate change in its first assessment report. Produced over several years by a team of hundreds of scientists from around the globe, the report went into voluminous detail on the potential changes in temperatures and ecosystems and outlined a variety of strategies to mitigate these effects. The IPCC scientists classified just 2 findings as being absolutely certain, however. These findings did not rely on complex models, and they did not make highly specific predictions about the climate. Instead, they were based on relatively simple science that had been well understood for more than 150 years, and which is rarely debated even by self-described climate skeptics. They remain the most important scientific conclusions about climate change today. The IPCC's first conclusion was simply that the greenhouse effect exists. There is a natural greenhouse effect that keeps the Earth warmer than it otherwise would be. The greenhouse effect is the process by which certain atmospheric gases, principally water vapor, carbon dioxide, CO2, methane, and ozone, absorb solar energy that has been reflected from the Earth's surface. Were it not for this process, about 30% of the sun's energy would be reflected back out into space in the form of infrared radiation. That would leave the Earth's temperatures much colder than they actually are, about 0 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 18 degrees Celsius on average, or the same as a warm day on Mars. Conversely, if these gases become more plentiful in the atmosphere, a higher fraction of the sun's energy is trapped and reflected back onto the surface, making temperatures much warmer. On Venus, which has a much thicker atmosphere consisting almost entirely of carbon dioxide, the average temperature is 460 degrees Celsius. Some of that heat comes from Venus's proximity to the sun, but much of it is because of the greenhouse effect. There is no scenario in the foreseeable future under which the Earth's climate will come to resemble that of Venus. However, the climate is fairly sensitive to changes in atmospheric composition, and human civilization thrives within a relatively narrow band of temperatures. The coldest world capital is Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, where temperatures average about negative 1 degree Celsius or plus 30 degrees Fahrenheit over the course of the year. The warmest is probably Kuwait City, Kuwait, where they average plus 27 degrees Celsius plus 81 degrees Fahrenheit. Temperatures can be hotter or cooler during winter or summer, or in sparsely populated areas. But the temperature extremes are modest on an interplanetary scale. On Mercury, by contrast, which has little atmosphere to protect it, temperatures often vary between about negative 200 degrees Celsius and plus 400 degrees Celsius over the course of a single day. The IPCC's second conclusion made an elementary prediction based on the greenhouse effect. As the concentration of greenhouse gases increased in the atmosphere, the greenhouse effect and global temperatures would increase along with them. Emissions resulting from human activities are substantially increasing the atmospheric concentrations of the greenhouse gases carbon dioxide, methane, chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, and nitrous oxide. These increases will enhance the greenhouse effect, resulting on average in additional warming of the Earth's surface. The main greenhouse gas, water vapor, will increase in response to global warming and further enhance it. This IPCC finding makes several different assertions, each of which is worth considering in turn.